rabbi sold I to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Kanata. This is your host, Kevin Annett, back once again. It's December 18th, 2016. We're here today, a week before Christmas, to remember, to start off remembering Maisie Shaw, a little girl, 14 years old, who was killed on Christmas Eve, 1946, by Principal Alfred Caldwell at the United Church's Indian Residential School in Port Alberni. And 21 years ago today, December 18th, 1995, that story broke for the first time. It was historic because it was the first time an eyewitness had come forward to describe the murder of a child at a Christian Indian school in Canada. That witness was Harriet Nahani, and at the time, she was the age I am now, age 60, and she came forward and told the story in her own words. I want you to listen to those words right now.
And she was standing at the top of the stairs, and he kicked her. She went rolling downstairs. She ended up out, and she was laying like this. Her eyes were open, but she was moving. She wasn't crying. So.
Now, Harriet and I really began this campaign 20 years ago to bring out the truth of the residential schools. And today we're going to be talking on the show with two Native women, Katie Stokwell, who's here with me now, my co-host. Katie helped set up Radio Free Kanata, although she hasn't been on too much. She's from the Algonquin Nation. And also our guest, Lillian Shirt, a Cree elder from northern Alberta who was a survivor of the Blue Quills Catholic School and the Kamsel Insean Hospital run by the United Church. Now, today we're going to go into not only the fact of this crime and what can be done about it today, but what really the basic moral question is, who are we as a people, Euro-Canadians, who are we that we could have done this and that we continue to deny it and cover it up? Let me bring on Katie, first of all. Katie, welcome.
Hi, Kevin. How are you?
Well, I'm good. I'm still here kicking after 21 years. So
it's good to be back with you.
Well, yeah.
It's been a while.
Yeah, it has been. And I do want to emphasize that this is a dialogue show. This is a way to bring up the truth, because we find it's like working with survivors over many years. The truth came out in the course of dialogue. No expert coming forward, but simply the truth that everyone carries in themselves coming out. So feel free to, you know, to bear that in mind.
Grassroots, 21 years since the story broke where Harriet Nahani dared to speak the truth about what occurred in those concentration camps. And it was definitely, it's been definitely a grassroots effort all along. So my question for you is what does the death of Maisie Shaw represent for you?
Well, you know, there's kind of it's a big question to answer, but I want to tell you just briefly before we bring on Lillian to kind of set the tone here. It happened right at the very same time that my life was coming apart, that the United Church had fired me. The very same month that this story broke, the first lawsuits began against the United Church, and the church moved against me. They ended my marriage. They helped my ex-wife divorce me. They arranged to have my children taken from me in family court, and they delisted me or threw me out of the United Church. So taking family and livelihood away right at the very time the story broke, you know, that I lost my own children, it's a deeply personal memory for me. But on a broader sense, it really opened the door to this whole reality of the mass murder of children. All of the stuff today, the so-called Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the accounts that are coming out now, the people coming forward, all the compensation programs, it all started 21 years ago today with this article.
Her, Maisie's death clearly, you know, was a springboard for you and many others, some now gone, some transitioned into what I call the spirit world. And but there's definitely still quite a following that are trying to battle this monster.
Well, yeah, absolutely. You know, the other amazing thing, Katie, about this story that, of course, is lost now to most people's memory, but the amazing pressure that started to come down on Harriet and Hani and I the minute we began to talk about the story publicly. For example, I got a call immediately from the Paul Wilms, who was an RCMP officer heading the so-called task force in the residential schools, where Wilms said, and this is a dialogue we had in the parking lot of a radio station just within a month after this article broke, he said to me, you know, in the future, you better come to us first, that is the RCMP, whenever you have evidence. And I said, really? Well, why is that? He said, well, even if Alfred Caldwell, this is the guy who killed Maisie Shaw, even if Caldwell was alive today, he wouldn't get convicted, he said. And some people are getting very upset about what you're doing and may take action to stop you. So you better come to us. In other words, a threat.
Yes.
From the RCMP immediately to shut up about this.
Yeah. And of course, you know, we all know that the RCMP are directly involved. And why in God's name would you go to the very organization that is committing the crimes?
They were commissioned in the 1930s to be the police arm of the residential schools. They were the ones who went into the villages and grabbed the kids. They would track the children down when they ran away. We have accounts of Mounties helping to bury children who'd been killed and falsify death records. It goes on and on. So it's like, why would you go to the Canadian government and the churches for compensation or apology? They're the criminals, right? And I know that Lillian Shirt, who's going to come on today, has... She's on in our film Unrepentant, which was released 10 years ago now, but she's an eyewitness there describing finding little skulls in a furnace in the Blue Quill School, little skulls of babies that she found in the furnace because it was a common way of getting rid of the bodies, burn them up. You know, so, I mean, this stuff goes on and on.
For sure. So Maisie's death 21 years ago, did this happen around the time that you were going or experiencing the loss of your children? Like, were they had they already been taken from you? Was this around the same time?
Well, the church had gone to my ex-wife Anne and said, basically, we can help you with this divorce if you want to settle, if you want to leave the guy, because he's never going to work again in this country. They told him that. That came out in the divorce trial.
Right.
And so they plotted the divorce, and one day I came back, and she had took my two daughters. They were 6 and 3 at the time. She took them and left. I didn't know where they were for a week, but that was coordinated with Brian Thorpe, who was the head conference officer for the United Church in B.C., who also was organizing my defrocking from the church. So it was definitely a criminal conspiracy, and that's what people don't, in Canada, it's kind of hard for them to imagine that church and government and the courts would all get together to stomp on one person just because they're bringing out the truth of their dirty laundry. But it happened to me.
Yeah. Well, I came across quite accidentally, perhaps not so accidentally, a YouTube of Alex Jones interviewing you not that long ago, and he was talking about how the pushback, or how incensed Canadians were at Alex Jones for talking about the Canadian genocide, and he was saying that Canadians couldn't believe that this would be happening in their own backyard. And they were calling him a liar, and, you know, you don't have your facts. And this was directed at him, not you. They just, and he couldn't believe it. And of course, Alex is quite the researcher, and he knows he does his homework.
Well, yeah, definitely. And, you know, the thing about that too is that people say, well, where's the proof? We have documented this so thoroughly. People who are listening for the first time today on the air can go to murderbydecree.com. That's our book that came out this year, one of four books I published this year, but it's the counter-report to the government's whitewash called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. It has all the hard evidence, the documents showing the 50% plus death rate over 40 years, the sterilization programs, the eyewitnesses. It's so thoroughly documented, and yet people don't want to see the evidence.
Yeah,
so they
don't want to look at it.
No. Absolutely. Yeah. So it's not a question of lack of evidence. It's people don't want to face who they are and what their history is.
But the first common law court case, international court case that was held, I've personally sat down and listened to hours and hours of testimony by natives, and you know, listened to the various evidence presented, and it is an absolutely astounding piece of work. And I applaud those, I commend those who put that whole thing together. And I encourage people to listen to it. It is quite a piece of evidence.
Yeah, well, the thing people need to understand, too, this was gathered painstakingly over 20 years,
yes.
This stuff. People don't understand, you know, what was involved.
Yes, yeah. And it's evident, though, you know, the time and just the effort that was put into putting that whole thing together.
Right. Now, to another announcement, well, Lillian should be on any moment, but our general website for people is itccs.org. That's the International Tribunal of Crimes of Church and State, itccs.org. One of the, pieces of evidence on there is a woman, Irene Favel, describing seeing a newborn baby thrown into a furnace by a Catholic priest in Saskatchewan at a residential school. And, this kind of stuff is constant, and if you look at our documentary Unrepentant as well, Lillian and others are on there. Lillian describing, mm-hmm. I remember one of the really moving pieces we have is when she says that there were these children locked in a closet, and you could hear them crying, and then their breathing and crying stopped, and they never saw them again. I mean, these stories of death and torture and that, I'd be hearing constantly from eyewitnesses, and yet at the official level, you never see it reported in the papers. The TRC never reported it. Total whitewash.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I hear you, Kev. It's really quite mind-boggling that 21 years later, it hasn't stopped. If anything, it's gotten worse. And you know, that's why we're here today, to talk about that.
Right.
And to talk about how we can stop this.
Now, I've got a note from my operator here that he can't get Lillian at the moment. I know she had to step out and should be back soon.
Yeah.
She's battling in Edmonton winter, so maybe she's delayed a bit. But
oh, no.
One thing I wanted to ask you, I know that you had experience back east when you were at various churches, I think Anglican churches and others,
yeah.
Where you were handing out information. And I think the response you got was indicative so much, despite all of this evidence coming out, where white Canadians are still out on this whole issue.
Yeah, you know, when I, what started this all out for me was, for me personally, researching my family genealogy, and my great-great-grandmother is pure Native, and I went to family members, specifically my uncle, who was in possession of oral writings of my family. And in one of the stories, it talked about my great-great-grandmother, who she had diabetes. And back in the day, the church held the insulin. And so it was a Jesuit priest who specifically had her medication, and so she had to go to him for the injection, or to get it, to give the injection to herself, and he wouldn't give it to her, and he told her to go home and pray for healing, he was quite nasty with her, and he just refused to give it to her. Well, she goes home, and 3 days later she dies. And so before I even found you and all this evidence, I had acquired quite a bit of evidence just in the oral family writings.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I found your stuff, it wasn't that big of a stretch to believe it.
Right.
And so, you know, that was a springboard for me learning more about what the church and state are doing. And then when I came across, jumping ahead, when I came across this Crimen Solicitanus, I specifically brought it to, you know, who I would consider friends of mine in the church.
Do you want to say what that is, the Crimen Solicitanus?
Oh, where the priests are to cover up any reporting to cover up child rape.
Right.
In essence, is what the document is. And so I specifically brought it to people who, in my mind, were sane, were sound mind, and I would think, well, of course, you know, they're going to listen to me, and it was quite the opposite. It was like I had been hit with a 2x4 upside my head. I had threats. Emails saying things like, don't bring this trash into my home. And it was simply an email presenting the evidence, threatening to call the RCMP on me.
For what? For sharing the truth.
It was completely insane. And I didn't stick around.
Right.
Like for me, on a spiritual level, I saw it as, okay, you know what? I did my part. I've presented you the truth. You've turned from it for whatever reason, and I basically left it at that. I didn't really force it by any means, mind you. I chased this for many months until I basically said, that's it. That my part is done. Now it's between you and God.
Right. And now something you said was very important, I think, in terms of understanding the psychology of denial, how culture commits mass murder and genocide and then pretends it never happened or minimizes it, right?
Yes.
In their own mind. In Unrepentant, there's a part just before that little clip I played about Harriet describing the killing of Maisie Shaw. I said, until I experienced the attack by the church on myself, it was all still very abstract. I'd heard people's stories, I'd seen documents, but it still didn't make any sense to me. It wasn't real until these same church officers...
Until it happens to yourself.
Well, these same church officers were showing no compassion. I was asking them, pleading with them. I said, I have two children. It's in the middle of winter. Do not take this job away. Let's negotiate. There was not a shred of humanity in them.
Yeah.
So as I said on Unrepentant, when I saw what they could do to one of their own, imagine what they could do to a native child who is not a Christian, who is seen as an enemy. Of course they could kill them, either through neglect or direct murder, like exposing children to TB en masse, which was a common method of depopulating. Mm-hmm. That's been proven by Dr. Peter Bryce and other government doctors. We have all of the evidence that went on. So until it's real in our own life, it's still abstract, and maybe that's part of the problem here, that there's nothing in people's lives in so-called white Canada that can relate to this stuff, except their own abuse as a child, which might be a trigger, you know?
Yeah, no, I agree, and the thing about, I'll use the term white people, is, you know, there's so many people, I have a friend who still goes to the very church that I presented this evidence to. She admits, sure, she doesn't deny that it isn't true. I sat down with her, and we've gone, looked at basically the facts, and she still continues to go, and it escapes my heart and my soul as to how and why. But then you look at her life, and I think, you know, she really hasn't had any real experience as far as having anything bad happen to her or any real trauma kind of thing. She's quite content with her life.
Right.
And unfortunately, I think that too many of us need something horrible to happen or to be jolted into some kind of, you know, making a journey on this awakening that I am seeing presently globally. It's happening. People are waking up, but the awakening seems to be, as far as I can observe, coupled with them, people having real experiences, like having their children ripped away from them for no reason.
Yep.
And unfortunately, that needs to happen to wake people up.
That suffering component.
Yeah.
It has to be present. And, you know, it might sound like a cruel thing from the outside to hear that, but what I often say to people in counseling, and I would say this as a minister, your experience, your own experience, never lies.
Yeah.
You have to take your experience seriously because we're all abused in some way, and the first thing you have to recover is your own voice and say, yes, this happened to me. I'm not making it up. Evil has a name. I know who did this to me, mm-hmm. and I'm going to name it. And until we can get, and that's the trouble with, you know, in counseling when they always say, well, you got to forgive people and move on. By doing that, you're kind of muffling yourself. You're gagging yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they do with survivors all the time. When they say, well, these things are in the past. No, they're not in the past. No. The children are still being trafficked. Native people are still being forced off their land. This genocide carries on, and we're helping it carry on.
Yeah. Yeah, the crimes continue. And how, in God's name, do you... there's forgiveness and not forgetting. But when the crimes are still occurring, and then you have... you know, a white person saying, oh, but, you know, that's in the past, and now you need to forgive. It's easier said than done. It's still happening to this specific population. It's happening globally, just in different ways.
Yeah, and I, you know, one of the things that we do emphasize on our show, Radio Free Canada, is activating people. So we're not just describing a problem, and I always make a point of saying to listeners, we're going to give you a taste of what the problem is, but we're going to really focus on what we do about it. Now, the history of this whole campaign in Canada is really fascinating because out of this education period where we were trying to educate people and pressure the churches to reveal stuff, the government and the churches respond with their cover-up on a massive scale, an increasingly massive scale, the more we bring out. And I remember after we released our film Unrepentant in 2007, and one of the members of Parliament, a Native guy called Gary Morasty, saw Unrepentant. And he gets up in Parliament and voices our demand. He says, when are we going to bring these children home for a proper burial? After that, the Harper government starts announcing a missing children's inquiry that never occurred.
Mm-hmm.
They brought in the compensation money and this TRC nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
And if when you read the mandate of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, it's mind-blowing. It says, basically, they cannot take down in evidence anything that might implicate a church, that could name a crime, that would, in any way implicate anyone in a crime. You couldn't even name a perpetrator. You mm-hmm. could name it, but they weren't allowed to take it down as evidence. Well, you know, all of this is just a capital W whitewash.
Mm-hmm.
And yet that whitewash is now the official version, and Canadians say, well, look, we've looked at it, we've examined it. No, you haven't. And
mm-hmm.
so the next stage is, well, it doesn't matter what they do. They were convicted. The Anglican, Catholic, and United Church, the Vatican, the Crown of England, Government of Canada were all convicted by a lawful court in 2013. It's why Ratzinger, the Pope, stepped down. It's why the head of the Jesuits then stepped down, Adolfo Pichon. They were named in this conviction. And so we're now in a position where we say, under the law, these churches are convicted criminal bodies. You give money to those bodies, and you're committing a crime. They do not have the right to legally operate, nor does the Crown. So Canada, in effect, is null and void.
Mm-hmm.
And we're faced with a situation now, what do we put in this place? And that's where we're at. We're not in a position of asking for anything anymore. We're in a position of reclaiming. I mean, first we're remembering, now we're reclaiming the nation. And then there's a reckoning. And I want to later, you know, as we go through the show, I'm going to talk about that reckoning. But what are your thoughts on all that?
Well, no, I agree that this business of asking, oh, can we do this? Are we allowed to do this? You hear it all the time. Yet those who are saying it are either, A, they're not awake. There's a lot of fear base there. I even hear natives who have taken the money when people got when you're the one who brought the evidence that started the lawsuits, is that right?
Yeah, very much. Obviously, an advisor to the very first lawsuit in 1996 that brought out the first conviction of the United Church and the government.
So now the lawsuits are settled, and so what I hear people saying is, "Oh, we can't do that though because we've already taken the money, and then they think that they can't. The natives think that they can't do anything presently because they've taken the funds."
Well, you know,
have you come across any of that?
Oh, all the time. Now, here's a very important point for any Native person listening or anyone else who thinks that they're suddenly muzzled by this thing. Yes, there's a document they had to sign which indemnified the churches. It said,
What does that mean?
Well, to indemnify means you release from any responsibility.
Okay.
Okay. So it means when to take the check, they had to sign a piece of paper saying, "I will never sue the churches again on this." However, just because you sign that, first of all, you're doing it under duress. It means that I know that if I don't sign, I'm never going to get any compensation. Mm-hmm. And if you're destitute and need the money, whatever. So it's not a bona fide contract in that it's done under duress. Mm-hmm. Secondly, it doesn't matter what you sign. Under natural law, people who commit crime, and they're not absolved by it, by any statute, by any legal contract. They are still guilty under the laws of God and man for what they did. So all of this nonsense of TRC, compensation, apology, it hasn't reduced by one iota the guilt of those churches. And the fact that any Native person can go in and perform a citizen arrest, anyone can, on these churches, because that document you mentioned earlier, Crimen Solicitanus, it's a policy document saying in any Catholic church, when a child is raped, it's to be covered up. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a criminal conspiracy, and any priest in the world is engaged in that criminal conspiracy. Mm-hmm. So these are criminal bodies operating. We have the right to go in and stop them from operating if it's going to cause children to be harmed.
And the fact that the churches in the state were already involved and immersed in this criminal conspiracy, it doesn't matter what you signed in the first place,
right?
Because it's illegitimate.
Right. Now people say, okay, fine, we can act against them still, but how do we act? That's why for the last 2 years, a big focus of what we've been doing is on the common law courts. And I just want to flag for people listening, next Sunday, that's Christmas Sunday, December 25th, we're not going to be on the air live. We're going to play because we're going to take a break. You know, why not? we're going to replay the interview Ryan Gable and I did together a few weeks ago, where we did a kind of online 1-hour-long mini workshop on the common law. So please tune in next week to get that. But one thing people need to know is that we have the mechanism set up now where people can set up their own common law courts, especially a Native person, because their tribal law is still in place. Under their own traditional law, they can say, look, you're on our territory under land law jurisdiction. We have the right to put you on trial. We're going to find where our children are buried. We're going to put you on trial, and you can get off our land now. There's been eviction orders issued against the Catholic, Anglican, and United Churches in Vancouver by Chief Capilano of the Squamish Nation. I was there when he posted it on the door. And it was funny because the police showed up, as they always do, on our protests. And I said to the police, I handed them this eviction order, and I said, you're obligated under the law to enforce this bona fide court order. And he looked at it, and he said, well, if it's bona fide, yes, I'd have to enforce it. Well, there you go, people. The police know what they have to do under the law. And after that, it was interesting. The police never hassled us again because they knew we were standing on the law, and they didn't want to be around in case they had to evict these priests from the church.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we have tremendous power.
Mm. And, you know, historically, Natives, under natural law, we use the term natural law, sovereignty. Historically, Natives settled disputes that way.
Right.
There was no, I mean, clearly there was no court system, but collectively they got together and they just naturally settled any disputes based on natural law, the law of balance, the law of nature.
That's right. And it's interesting that you say that, because both Columbus and Amerigo Vespucci, who were the two early European invaders, on the east coast of Turtle Island, they both said the same thing. They have no government. They have no courts. They live He said they live as equals, so they don't need to have law.
Mm-hmm.
They work it out among themselves, and that's exactly what we need to do. And that's really what's the philosophy behind common law. You can convene a jury in your neighborhood on any issue involving a crime, a civil or a criminal matter, and you are the law. You are the people. You're the source of sovereignty. So, you know, Katie, to get people to not only accept that but start acting on it, that's the biggest struggle. It isn't about the people, the criminals in power. We know what their crime is. They're not the problem. The problem is the lethargic, asleep people out there.
Themselves.
Who can't act on their own natural consciousness and sense of right. And I don't know what it takes to wake people up. We've had successes in some ways. Often it takes dramatic actions.
Mm-hmm.
We got to send like an electric shock through their system to wake them up. But the point is we got to keep trying all the time.
Do you think for, I guess, natives in particular, do you think that the trauma of experiencing these, or being a survivor of the concentration camps is what I call them, do you think the trauma, not only is it the trauma that has hindered them, but the fear has just immobilized them?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, classic cases, you know, the woman who stood up once in a healing circle and said, well, they used to yank her teeth out with painkiller. The dentist would come around once a month,
mm-hmm.
pull her teeth out or fill it without painkiller. So he would save on the Novocaine.
Sure.
Because they're just Indians. They don't need painkiller. Well, imagine if you're 5 years old having the teeth ripped out of your jaw. Would you ever go to a dentist? I mean, would you even talk about it? It's and then to say nothing of the beatings and the tortures and being forced to strangle your little pet to death. All of these sick things that are documented that they did, the electric shocks, the driving nails through the tongues and the hands, the raping, the tying of piano wire around boys' penises, all of this, it's all documented.
Trauma, yeah.
Now, you come out of that like a war veteran,
mm-hmm.
and you have all the symptoms. I don't even like to call it PTSD because it's mm-hmm. not post-traumatic. It's an ongoing trauma.
Ongoing, yeah.
And the reality is that you either become a basket case or you identify with your abuser. They sometimes call it the Stockholm Syndrome.
Yeah.
So I would often find natives acting very guilty, like, oh, I don't want to do this again. And the church people are still so nice to me. And often they go to church and give money. You know, it's this weird love your abuser mentality. But all you have to do is, you know, in any family it's the same way.
Yeah.
There's an abusing parent. The one person who speaks out becomes the pariah. Everybody hates them, and they evict them from the family. I mean, that's what happens to any of us who talk to the big family called Canada about this stuff.
Sure. Now, I believe that many people placed in high positions, governmental positions, I don't believe many of them have souls. I believe that the fact is that cloning does exist, and a clone cannot possess a soul, so there's no God connection. And I believe that factual evidence points to this, and that this is why certain individuals are able to commit such heinous crimes. It's like Caldwell is that the principal that kicked Maisie Shaw to her death, and then he, in the very same moment, he turns around and he goes and celebrates Christmas. Like, I can't get my head around that. Anyone with any conscience or a soul or has morality or compassion or empathy, that would affect them. And
well, that's true, and I, frankly, I'm open to any possibility. The things I've seen in life, I wouldn't put it past any.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. I remember a very interesting thing that happened. The first forum we ever held in Vancouver, it was February 9th, 1998, at the Simon Fraser University Harbor Center Auditorium. There was only a few whites there. I was one of the few whites there. The room was packed with over 300 natives. It was the first public forum we ever did on residential school crimes.
Mm.
And a white woman gets up. Her name was Maren McFarlane. And she said, I want to speak. I used to work in one of these places.
Mm-hmm.
And they started booing her and everything. But we said, no, let her speak. She said, she lasted there only 6 months because one day she discovered a little girl being, a little native girl being beaten to death by a matron holding a piano leg. She was whacking this little girl over the head with a piano leg. So Marion grabs the woman and knocks her cold to defend the little Indian girl.
Yeah.
Well, later, John Andrews, the principal, drags Marion in front of him and fires Marion. Doesn't fire the woman beating a little girl to death, but fires Marion.
Yeah.
And here's a quote from John Andrews. He said, anything that happened to the little squaw would have been preferable to losing that woman because she plays the organ on Sunday in church.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's the thing. You're they're not all psychopaths. They all are going along to get along. And the humanitarian people like Marion are forced out of the system.
Yeah.
And who do you have left? In a hierarchy, everybody looks the other way. And that's the thing about human beings. We have the ability to close off our heart,
mm-hmm.
look at our own little piece of the pie, saying, well, I'm just doing my job. I don't care what goes on down the hall there. Everybody does
Many people don't see it as themselves being used as a tool for Satan.
No, they don't.
Like the RCMP, like there is a select core that are committing horrendous crimes, and then there's the core of RCMP that aren't. But on the same breath, they're not doing anything to stop it. Like I just read in the news in the States, a whole sheriff department up and quit. Every single one of them together, and where in the States, I cannot remember. But that's putting it into action. And the reason why they quit is because they were all tired of the higher ups asking them to do things that were immoral, that were criminal, and they simply couldn't go along with it anymore, and they just up and quit. And wouldn't it just be wonderful if the good old RCMPs, even the ones ones that aren't committing the crimes, if they all band together and collectively just said, that's it, enough is a freaking enough.
Well, it's interesting to say that, Katie, because my friend Louis Lawless, who is the director of the film Unrepentant, he did another film that hasn't been released yet. It's called Behind the Red Surge. And it's a film about harassment on the job in the RCMP and the on-the-job rape of female RCMP officers,
it's
including
rampant.
Catherine Galliford out in on the West Coast.
Yeah.
And Louis found, I remember I went to one of these meetings, and I was sitting in the room with these 20 Mounties. And, you know, I was all prepared to be angry at these guys and that. But in fact, what it turned out, their stories were unbelievable. Every one of them had a story about how their commanders expected them to look the other way about the drug dealing going on, about the gun running going on, about their ties with the Hells Angels. And we know one of the things that lost me my 9-year spot on Vancouver Co-op Radio is I brought on two Native women who saw Mounties taking other Native women out to the Piggy's Palace, to the Picton serial killing farm,
mm-hmm.
where it wasn't the Pictons killing them, but it was politicians and senior government and police people out in Port Coquitlam killing them. And all these Mounties were talking about, but they said, we don't know what to do because under the Mounties Code of Ethics or rules, just like in a church, they're a self-governing body. They have their own courts. So just like what happened to me, when I was being thrown out and had all my civil rights violated and there was a criminal conspiracy against me, the Attorney General of BC, Ujjal Dosanjh, wrote and said, and here's another quote, the internal procedures of a church are outside the jurisdiction of my department, i.e. outside the law of the land. Churches can do whatever they want to people within their own ranks, including kill them if they're Indian kids, just like the Mounties can put away a whistleblown Mountie for 20 years in a military stockade and you'll never hear from them again. So until we break up those systems of power, there's no point telling the truth. You're going to be locked away. We have to dismantle those institutions, and that's what we keep coming back to the common law about.
Yeah. So do you believe in reckoning?
There is a reckoning coming, and it has nothing to do with us. It's an act of God, and I know it for a fact. There's a spiritual reckoning coming. We're seeing it, you know, that I do very much believe that this culture, my culture, that has so many centuries of blood on its hand and violated its own spiritual foundations, you know, that crucified Christ and his teachings, and now have the gall to stand up and pretend to represent him. that society is over. It's fallen. And what we say to people is, this isn't a human rights issue. This is a fundamental spiritual, yes, existential issue. You cannot be part of the Sodom anymore.
Yeah, it's a spiritual battle for sure.
We have to leave the old Sodom. It's coming down. And you have a toehold in the system, and you'll be going down too. You know, that's
Do you see, or can you feel or experience the system coming apart presently as we speak?
It's a ghost. It's like whenever I'm in a city, whenever I'm around any of these churches, it's like a dead zone. It feels like there's nothing there. I had the same experience when I did the first exorcism in Rome, mm-hmm, in 2009 in the fall. I expected to be overwhelmed. I'm standing there in St. Peter's Square, and I shut my eyes, and it feels like there's nothing there. It's a void. It's nothingness. And yet people give their energy, you know, to that void all the time and give it life. It's feeding off us. It's a system of spiritual vampirism. Mm-hmm. And we have to, at a mental level, an energetic level, personal level, pull our energy out of it. We can't do any activism. We can't talk about justice at common law courts or anything until we make that first personal step.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you continually talk about reclaiming our minds, and I wholeheartedly agree that the battle is with ourselves. We have soul, we have God, well, some of us do, have soul or God connection, and we have free will. And it's what we're here experiencing on this planet for soul growth. And we, you know, the reincarnation has been written out of the Bible for obvious reasons, and the Christianity has been used to lie and dupe the masses. And if people think that they can go around and continue to commit these crimes and there isn't going to be consequences, you're sadly mistaken.
That's right. The reckoning we're talking about is happening as we speak, and
yeah,
we see it everywhere. And the problem is, today people are so split up in their consciousness and so prone to fight each other and to doubt each other that it's really hard to find that basis of unity with people. You know, I've been trying for years, and the level of hysteria is growing all the time. Fear and hysteria, and we have to go back, and I really urge people who are listening to this, find a piece of land outside the city, find a way to replenish yourself on that land, be around children, be around animals,
yeah,
recover our humanity. Mm-hmm. We have to do a lot more than that, but if we don't carry that vital light within ourselves, we can't ignite anything else. And so, you know, when you mentioned earlier about some of the police are disobeying their orders, those people, when you talk to the people who make that moral commitment, look at their history, every one of them will have suffered in some way, but in that suffering, they recovered the thing that can never be taken from us,
yeah,
that we carry around. I found it when my own children were taken from me. I thought I was going to die. My heart was broken, and yet I was stronger. There was a strength I had that I never knew I had until that moment of loss.
Yeah.
And it's the same with all of us. So once people find that, they become indestructible. And then we can build on that. Then we have to unite that remnant, and that's really the focus. We're not speaking to most people. We're speaking to the remnant out there, and any of you who are listening, you know who you are.
Yeah. Well, the audience that is listening presently to me, you guys are the remnant. You guys are the miracle, And we got to stop looking outside of ourselves, because it's all within. We all have spirit guides, and you're never ever alone. You just have to quiet oneself long enough. The question compels the answer always. And if you have a sincere heart or intent, when for whatever it is you're seeking, the question, the answers will come, or a person will come into your life that'll answer those questions. It's quite extraordinary. I mean, we're so caught up in the physicalness of being here, and the adversary knows it, that it's a spiritual battle. But this is why we have so many distractions, physical distractions, Christmas, buying gifts, buy, you know, and we forget about it. It's an inward journey.
Right, and it's interesting, you know, just a little thing on Christmas for next week when we're not on the air, but you're hopefully listening to the Common Law Workshop a week from now. Saturnalia, which was the Roman festival on December 25th, Saturnalia was the time of year in Rome where the rich people and the poor people had to change positions. So there'd be this big guy owning a lot of land, and he'd have, say, 100 slaves. Well, on Saturnalia, the slaves got to take over, and for a day they pretended to be the master, and the master had to be the slave. And okay, it was a token gesture, but the point is there's a message there. Why would the early Christians adopt December 25th to represent Jesus? Well, when you look at his message, it's all about overturning things. The last shall be first, the first shall be last. The meekest shall inherit the earth.
The meek shall inherit the earth,
There's a passage in the book of Corinthians that says, God has chosen the low things of the earth to bring to nothing the things that are.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's talking of a great spiritual reversal, and every time I think about what we've gone through, it's not an end in itself, the struggle. It's a way to illuminate some of us to see that we may be nothing by the terms of the world, but we are everything because we're standing in God's power.
That's right.
And the truth and the innocence of those children who are still looking to us to bring them out of that darkness simply by saying their names and what happened to them. So I want to just kind of leave that with people. We've only got 5 minutes left, and I want to, you know, give you a chance to say anything you want to say. And Lillian, I think, got caught up in the snow somewhere in Edmonton, so I'm gonna find out.
Well,
she was supposed to go out on
an
errand and got lost or something. I don't know, but we'll find out. And
I just want to close with, I know that this is no easy task, bringing forth the truth. I know a lot of people out there feel alone. And don't have support. And there's a lot of people out there who are quite fearful for their lives, for their family, for their children. So on a spiritual note, I just want to say that when you find yourself frightened or in doubt, ask inwardly for guidance. Just bring yourself to a quiet place, whether it's out in the bush or in your backyard, and ask. So when you're afraid, ask for that protective white light, which is God, and ask for that light to surround you and bring self back into a balanced state of reasoning and inner peace. And so I'll just leave it at that.
Thank you, Katie, and appreciate you being on, as always. We will be back live in 2 weeks. That's January 1st, first day of 2017. And that should be a very good year for a number of reasons we'll be telling you about on January 1st. I want to finally remind people again, the 4 books that we brought out this year are all very important. Murder by Decree, The Crime of Genocide in Canada. Unrelenting, Between Sodom and Zion, which tells the whole story of how this movement came about, and that spread is now spread all over the world with the ITCCS. Whistleblower Manual for those people who want to get involved in the struggle, and how to navigate smear campaigns and attacks by the adversary. The Truth Teller Shield, a whistleblower manual. And finally, number 4, which is out this week, and again, you get all of these books at Amazon.com or createspace.com. The final book this year is a little funny thing I wrote called 1497 and so on, A History of White People in Canada or the Caucasian Healing Fund. And you can get that again. I had fun writing it.
I'm sure that'll be quite comical.
Well, and we've got some nice images in there, too.
Yeah.
And a lot of interesting historic facts, like the first Prime Minister of Canada, John A. Macdonald, used to throw up on his political opponents all the time whenever he got drunk.
You're kidding.
Well, it happened once. He had a good comeback. But anyway, that's part of very important resources, those 4 books. So you can see more info at kevinanna.com, itccs.org, murderbydecree.com. And again, to remind folks, next week there'll be an online common law workshop for those who want to carry on with this. Thanks for all your emails. If you want to get in touch with us with program ideas or to be part of the show, write to Republic of Kanata, K-A-N-A-T-A, republicofkanata@gmail.com. We are part of a growing movement that have declared their spiritual and political sovereignty, separation from the murderous Crown of England, declaring a republic of equals under the common law. which stretches all over the world, but here too on the good soil of Canada. And we are building. We have groups and people all over the country, all over the world that are working with us. So if you want to be part of that, republicofcanada@gmail.com. And again, our thoughts go out to Lillian Shirt, wherever you are, and all the other
hopefully not stuck in some snowbank.
Well, we've had, all over the West, there's been bad snow, so I hope she's all right. But there's survivors all over who are still struggling to bring the story out. So we will air their voices again in the new year. And I just want to say to everyone, thank you. And please tune in 2 weeks and next week for the Common Law Workshop. And until then, brothers and sisters, we love you. We love our struggle. We will carry on until death and beyond. And until next week, be strong and stay clear. Thank you.
God bless.